It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee is the oldest school voucher program in America. We dive into the history of school choice and how it's become a partisan issue as more public dollars flow to private schools. You can be part of the discussion, calling in with a question, sharing your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kara Fitzpatrick is a story editor for the news outlet Chalkbeat. Her new book is called The Death of Public School, How Conservatives Won the War Over Education in America. Kara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So setting the scene here, voucher schools are private schools that use taxpayer dollars to subsidize the education of students from lower income families. Wisconsin having four state-run, state-funded programs, including the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. To what degree is Milwaukee the model for voucher programs in America?
Well, Milwaukee was the first in 1990, and it sort of set up the idea that these programs were targeted for specific groups, you know, primarily low-income children, and that was the model for decades. And now that started to change. You know, we're starting to see this push for universal vouchers where everyone, regardless of income, qualifies.
You talked about how Milwaukee was the perfect moment, the perfect city to launch a voucher program. What were the dynamics in Milwaukee that made it that environment?
Yeah, it's interesting because Milwaukee really was a place that almost seemed set up for this, because you had at the time, you know, concerns, pretty deep concerns, particularly in the Black community, about the quality of education that Black students were receiving in Milwaukee. You also had this history of independent private schools in Milwaukee that had a reputation for providing a quality education to Black students, to Latino students, you know, to low-income students. And so you already had that in the city. You know, those schools already existed and people respected that education that the kids there were receiving. And then you also had, you know, this dynamic of having Polly Williams, who was a state representative who was deeply interested in education and was very concerned about how Black students were doing. And it was this moment in time where I think people were looking for solutions to some of the problems in the school system, and school vouchers was one of the things that people started talking about.
And just noting here, State Representative Polly Williams in Wisconsin's legislature at that time, you know, you made a point of writing about former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos labeling America's public education system as racist in her book. What is the significance of a prominent conservative framing public schools this way?
Yeah, I thought that was sort of interesting, especially at this moment in time where you see Republicans really trying to, in a lot of states, really trying to control how teachers are talking about race and racism and that history in our country. And so I thought it was sort of interesting that Betsy DeVos would characterize the public school system as one of the only institutions in America as being racist, as opposed to any number of other institutions in America. And it sort of feeds into this idea that you need to give students a way out of the school system. And it's part of this history of referring to school choice as this civil rights issue that conservatives have done for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, how has the school choice movement attached itself to the civil rights movement, especially in the litigation?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there was disagreement. You know, there's disagreement within the movement about whether or not you really should do that, whether you should attach school choice to the civil rights movement and say that this is a civil rights issue. And there were some prominent voices within the movement who disagreed with that, who thought that school choice had to stand on its own. But it really took off. You know, conservatives used that idea really pretty prominently. You know, you had the president saying so, you had the education secretary saying so. And in the litigation, in the court case that finally the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, it was actually Cleveland's program, but yes, Cleveland's school vouchers can stand. We can have school voucher programs within certain parameters. And that was a key part of that litigation, that the side that was for school choice was saying, this isn't about sending tax dollars to religious schools. You know, this is about civil rights, and this is about giving educational opportunities, particularly to students of color.
We're
And
talking,
that,
oh, I'm sorry. I just
go
go.
ahead. I was just going to say that was a really winning argument.
We're talking about the history of school choice, the rise of the voucher program in Milwaukee. Kara Fitzpatrick is the author of the book, The Death of Public School. You can join the conversation calling in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Mike in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi. What comes up for you?
Good morning. Yeah, I called in the last time you had a show on 2 or 3 months ago, and I asked the same question. Basically, is how much of the Wisconsin taxpayers' dollars or the city of Milwaukee taxpayer dollars go to support the church structure? As opposed, I don't know. I guess they get so much per pupil, but how much of that money actually sticks with the pupil rather than doing other things in the church?
Mike, thank you for that question. Kara, what have you found through your research?
You know, I don't know dollar figures off the top of my head, but the way that the program works, at least in Milwaukee, is that the voucher pays for tuition. So how much of that ends up going to support, you know, how the school decides to use that money is up to them, essentially. You know, there's not, to my knowledge, a lot of control around that, but it's most likely just paying for tuition. You know, it's not necessarily supporting church functions outside of that religious education that someone might be receiving if it's going to a religious school, which many of them are.
There was also, you talked about in your book, the Lemon Test, and you know, court ruled that it was unconstitutional for a state to supplement the salaries of religious school teachers. And maybe that too perhaps probes a little bit into Mike's question about, you know, to what extent do these dollars flow to other things beyond that student's education?
I think you were the first person to ask me about the lemon test. I love it. You know, it's interesting because it's one of the questions that is throughout the entire legal history. You know, and early on, before Milwaukee's program, very early on, the Supreme Court was sort of wrestling with this idea of church-state separation, which is actually a little bit murkier. It's a murkier area of law than really I realized when I started the research. But it was kind of this issue of how much is this money supporting or advancing religion, and how much is really, you know, just providing this sort of secular function of giving a child an education. And over time, you know, over decades really, the court has gone more and more in the direction of supporting programs like this, and you know, and saying that as long as this is serving this function of providing education, then it's really okay. And also, if the money is getting there because parents are choosing that, then it's not the same as the government just giving money to a church.
Education editor Kara Fitzpatrick traces the history of school choice in Wisconsin and in other states, the rise of public dollars following a child to their preferred educational option. And the book is called The Death of Public School. You can be part of the conversation, call in with a question, share your views, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We examine the struggle over what constitutes public education and the rise of school vouchers in Milwaukee decades ago. Author Kara Fitzpatrick cites that more than half of states in the country now have publicly funded private school options. Her book is called The Death of Public School. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question or add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kara, Reverend Virgil Bloom, the political science professor at Marquette University in the 50s, you give us a fuller picture of Bloom in the book. And he published a book in 58 calling for state aid to religious schools. What are Bloom's main arguments?
So Bloom is an interesting figure, and I think he's a lesser known figure in this history. But he really was making a case, actually decades before a lot of people were, that this was an issue of religious liberty. And we've seen now in the last few years, the U.S. Supreme Court really under Roberts, you know, under Chief Justice John Roberts, go in this direction of talking more and more about religious liberty. But Bloom was making that argument in the 50s and 60s. And he was saying essentially that it was unfair, it was discrimination against religious families if they would be paying both taxes to support the public school system and also then, you know, in some cases maybe be struggling to pay tuition at, you know, say a Catholic school because that supported their values. And he really thought that if something was a public benefit, and he viewed education as a public benefit, then a religious education was serving much the same function, you know, that a public, traditional public education was. And so he thought that that was an issue of discrimination. And he really, you know, he really pushed for not just Catholics, but for all religious families to have some support, you know, taxpayer support for their education.
But in order to receive more financial support from the government, what were his thoughts on accountability to the public and how these children would be taught?
You know, it's interesting because Bloom really actually thought that in order to receive public dollars, that there should be some accountability. And he was somewhat different and maybe, again, ahead of his time in that respect. But he thought that, you know, if, say, a Catholic school was going to be receiving public dollars, that they should be open to, you know, financial audit and, you know, that perhaps they even needed to have sort of a similar, like an elected school board kind of idea, but for the Catholic school. And that, you know, that was something that made other supporters uncomfortable, having sort of that level of, they would say, government intrusion. And but he really thought that that was important if you were going to receive public dollars.
He also complained Catholics weren't taking advantage of their power as a voting bloc. What role did Catholics take as advocates for private school and what they had built through their schools?
Yeah, Bloom was sort of like delightfully cranky, I would say, in this respect. You know, he really was frustrated that Catholics weren't acting as a group, you know, and he really thought that if they did, they would have political power. But he sort of overlooked in a way the fact that not all Catholics actually agreed with the idea of vouchers, and some Catholics actually didn't want to open up their schools to have any kind of, you know, government involvement. That made them uncomfortable. And so there wasn't, I think, the widespread agreement that he really hoped for, you know, and so that was a point of frustration for him for basically his entire life.
Kara Fitzpatrick, author of The Death of Public Schools. We look at the history of school choice. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your questions and comments. Let's bring in Tim in Wausau now. Tim, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for the program and the discussion presented today.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Question. Well, and first to an earlier caller's comment, in 2021, I believe it was, the Wisconsin budget was at about $90 billion, and 12 of it went to public schools. In that year, to the caller's question, about $350 million went to vouchers that went straight from taxpayers throughout the state of Wisconsin. And some estimates have that up to over $400 million because of other subsidies, if you will. So anyways, just to kind of help with that one. But question, what do you think was the watershed moment that went from a trickle of vouchers to the voucher in every backpack? And I'll sign off and thank you again for the conversation.
Tim, thanks. Kara, what was that watershed moment for more and more voucher?
Well, thanks first for adding the information. I appreciate that. You know, I think right now, when we're seeing this massive push for school choice and very successful push for school choice, I think a lot of it just relates back to the pandemic. In this moment, you know, there have been earlier moments where there was a good amount of legislation passed, but this has really been kind of a historic wave. And a lot of that really is to do with the pandemic, just causing a certain amount of frustration with some of the choices that some public school districts made around closing and remote learning. And then also, I think that families in that moment saw a lot of opportunities and tried different things, you know, that maybe they wouldn't have absent the pandemic.
And just to note here, your book examines the history of school choice before the onset of the pandemic. And I guess if you could write additional chapters, what, you know, how transformational has the pandemic been on families looking for alternatives and then for the rise of other types of schooling?
Yeah, you know, I was writing the book during the pandemic, so it was sort of, it was hard to know exactly where it was going to go. And the legislation was passing at such a, you know, being proposed and then a lot of it passing at such a rapid rate, even as I was like editing the book, it was kind of crazy. But one of the big changes, you know, one of the largest shifts I've seen in the last few years with the pandemic, is this rise of education savings accounts, which are even more flexible than vouchers. And it's basically, it's a sort of a limited use savings account where taxpayer dollars go into that account, and a family who withdraws from public school, you know, or actually it didn't go there in the first place, but a family can use that money in a lot of different ways. So you could still pay tuition, but you could also maybe pay for transportation. In some states, you can actually pay for homeschooling costs. You can pay for therapies, you know, perhaps if your child has a disability and needs like occupational or speech therapy, something along those lines. And so that is really a surprising sort of development, you know, and I think we're up to 9 states now that have universal ESAs where every kid qualifies.
Let's go to Jack in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi there. I think it's very interesting because one of the thoughts that came to mind to me was thinking about the notion of school choice is the word choice, and it reminded me of the abortion debate, which is, you know, pro-choice versus pro-life nominally, and yet I think the stances here seem to be vice versa. And thinking about this notion of, like, this divide between funds going to school vouchers versus just funds going straight to public schools. And I wonder how we can sort of change the culture in a way, if you will, from being this divide between the school vouchers versus public education and just work to unify the public at large around public education and work to make that the default model of education for children in various states.
Jack, thanks for that. Kara, go ahead. What insights do you have there? And, you know, also the terminology of vouchers having baggage itself.
Yeah, the terminology is something that's really interesting. And I get so sort of wrapped up in my world of school choice that I refer to things as choice. And then you run into people who have different ideas of what we're talking about. But it's interesting because, you know, just as a small note, one of the reasons that advocates of school choice often frame it around choice and scholarships and some of these words as opposed to vouchers is that it actually has, over time, it's polled better. People like the idea of choice. It's a very appealing concept, and they like the idea of vouchers a little less. So it's just an interesting note on the terminology. But, you know, I think as far as the public school system being the default, that is still the case. You know, it is still the case that the majority of American kids are going to public schools. And if you include charters in that, that's a pretty high percentage of kids. But I don't, you know, I kind of went searching for a middle ground in this, and there isn't much of one. We're in such a polarizing moment in politics right now and in our country right now that there's not much middle ground. So I don't know if I can be super helpful as far as finding one.
You know, and in terms of that terminology, I mean, you found states that are using words like scholarships instead of vouchers or tuition grants. So I think that's really interesting as well as the language plays out around voucher programs. Kara Fitzpatrick examining experiments with school vouchers and the evolution of school choice in Wisconsin and across the nation in her new book. You can be part of this discussion about education. Call in with a question. You can share your perspectives. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore America's debate over school choice and how school vouchers and charter schools have changed the educational landscape in Milwaukee and other cities. The new book is called The Death of Public School. You can take part in this conversation. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Author and journalist Kara Fitzpatrick stays with us. Kara, let's shine a light on Pauli Williams, Democratic state lawmaker from Milwaukee who served for 30 years. In 1987, Williams approaches Republican Governor Tommy Thompson to propose this new school district made up of predominantly black schools in Milwaukee's, quote, inner core. Why was there this push for this school district?
Well, so it was not just Pauli Williams, it was also Howard Fuller, you know, who went on to become a superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools and is a pretty well-known school choice supporter there. But there was this idea that, you know, the school system was essentially, you know, in their view, failing black students. And because of a history of segregation and segregated schools in Milwaukee, you already had a part of the city where a number of schools were predominantly black. And so Pauli Williams and Howard Fuller sort of pushed this idea that you could carve out a piece of the city school district and essentially turn it into an all-Black school district, and that this would give those families a level of control and choice in their education that Pauli and Howard Fuller thought was missing from the existing system. And it was an idea that was very controversial. It was not supported by the NAACP.
They called it urban apartheid?
Yes, yes. I mean, because when you're talking about creating an all-Black school district, in a lot of people's minds, you're going back to days of Jim Crow. You're going back to this idea of segregated schooling, which, you know, we know to be harmful to children. And so it was very controversial. And I think that it really wasn't going to go anywhere, but it did raise some attention to this idea of, well, how are Black students doing in Milwaukee public schools?
So Pauli Williams and Republican Governor Tommy Thompson, they aligned. Thompson gains enough support to pass a limited school voucher plan for Milwaukee. How does Thompson gather support to pass this plan in a legislature that was controlled by Democrats at the time?
Well, you know, he tried. Tommy Thompson was interested in school vouchers, actually, before Pauli Williams kind of came into that idea. And he tried to pass a voucher plan a couple times before and wasn't successful. I mean, just not didn't go anywhere at all. Mm-hmm. And so it really wasn't until Pauli Williams kind of came into that idea and joined forces with him and really brought a lot of the Black community in Milwaukee along that gained any traction. And I think part of the success of that was that it was a very small, you know, it was meant to be a very small program. It was in one city, you know, it had some of this grassroots community support. And so that gave it enough of a push that you could bring along enough Democrats to pass it and then had, you know, fairly widespread Republican support.
In 1995, Governor Tommy Thompson aims to expand the Milwaukee school voucher program to include religious schools. And he says school choice is about, quote, education serving the public. And you say that this statement, this word choice is important. What did you find there?
This is an idea that I thought was really interesting that you see a lot today and a little bit less so at the time. But it's this idea of sort of, what is public education? You know, we think of a public school traditionally as what you see in cities all across the country, but a school that's secular, that's tuition free, that's essentially open to everyone and generally has some boundaries, you know, some zone issues there. And what Thompson was kind of talking about and what has become really a Republican viewpoint over time is this idea that any education paid for with the support of tax dollars is education in the public interest, and therefore it is also public education, and that could include religious education. And so that's a really different take on what public education is.
How did Polly Williams feel about that?
You know, I think Polly Williams was interested in school choice for a very particular reason. You know, she saw it as a tool of empowerment, you know, that school vouchers in particular were a tool of empowerment for low-income children. And, you know, her particular interest really was in students of color and providing more opportunities for kids who didn't have the ability to choose because maybe they weren't wealthy enough or they couldn't move, you know, some of the things that affluent families do. And so she wasn't really about this sort of larger conservative push for state aid to private education. She was really about kind of this more progressive view, you might say, of school vouchers as empowering particular groups of students.
We're talking about the history of school choice. Kara Fitzpatrick, author of The Death of Public School. You can join in along the way with a question, comments, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Colleen in Darlington now. Colleen, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
Well, my question is, how come I believe there's been two schools in Milwaukee, I don't know, their vouchers, charters, you know, closed in the middle of the night, no warning to the parents or everything, and they have no accountability? I mean, if that happened in a public school, God, the chaos would just be, the outrage would be unbelievable.
Colleen, thanks for calling in. Kara, what about the collapses of some schools? What did you find there?
Yeah, you know, this issue came up fairly early on with Milwaukee, where within the first few years, you had a couple of schools or a few schools, really, where they had financial problems or they had even fraud and abruptly closed. And so all of a sudden, these kids who are using vouchers to attend this school have to find somewhere else to go. And often they end up going back to the public system. And that issue, you know, that is throughout the school choice movement's history. That has happened in every place where they've had this. And it raises this kind of question of, you know, accountability, because if you're giving schools money and taxpayer dollars, and maybe they have shaky finances, or maybe they're not being run very well, and they close, and all of these kids are set adrift, you know, is this kind of a good use of taxpayer dollars? And that question has been there since the start.
It also, I think, speaks to, as you said, you know, some ballooning costs that you see in running parallel or multi different types of education for students that are supported in some way through the government. What do you see in this type of spending and what the future could hold?
Well, it's a difficult thing because you have a public school system that really is obligated to provide an education for any student who walks in the door. And when you have, you know, mechanisms where children can leave and choose other things year to year, and you don't know necessarily how many are going to come or go, it creates, you know, a certain amount of uncertainty in trying to plan for the public system. And that can result in, you know, small schools where you have the cost of maintaining this school, you know, you have to have a principal and maybe you have to have an assistant principal and you have to keep the lights on and you have to have a bus. But, you know, half the kids leave. And so now the cost of running that school is much higher than it was. You know, there's that kind of dynamic to this where it's really hard for school districts to sort of sort out who they're going to be serving and how much money they're going to have. And it can change year to year.
Madeline from Green Bay called in. Madeline says most people don't realize that private schools do not have to accept children who have intellectual disabilities. And Madeline thinks private schools should be required to accept some percentage of these children. What did you find, you know, as you looked at who was being accepted into schools, especially, you know, children going into either charter schools or voucher programs?
Yeah, this is a big issue, you know, because some voucher programs are actually meant for students with disabilities, and some states, including Wisconsin, have programs for students with disabilities. But then, you know, parents who use those programs have to be aware that when they leave the public school system, they lose some of their rights. You know, if you go to a public school and your child has a disability, then by federal law, that child is entitled to certain services, and you go through a process of deciding what services the child is going to be provided. And, you know, there's a whole very involved process that a family can go through. When you leave the public school system, you know, because maybe it's not working for your child with disabilities, what you can run into is that the private schools don't have that same obligation to serve you. And so you have to really work to find a place that's going to support that child in the same way. And that can be really tricky.
Hmm. Education editor and author Kara Fitzpatrick's book traces the history of voucher programs and charter schools. We'll talk more about charters in a moment here. And also the birth of the voucher program in Milwaukee decades ago. You can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the future of American education as the line between public and private schools becomes increasingly blurred through school choice and Wisconsin's role in this history. Kara Fitzpatrick is author of The Death of Public School. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Kara, looking at charter schools now, we talked with the head of a Wisconsin nonprofit recently that supports charter schools, came on our program, said there isn't a stark difference between the academic performance of charter schools and other public schools in the state. This is Sarah Hackett.
When I look at Wisconsin data, I would say that there is not a ton that is going to make you say aha, you know, like it's all like, oh, a little bit higher here, a little bit lower there, but nothing that's going to push either way off the map.
Kara, is this view in line with research on the effectiveness of charter schools?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because at the start of this, charter schools started around the same time that vouchers did in sort of the modern era in 1991 in Minnesota. And there was kind of this open question as to whether or not they would be better. And now, you know, 30 some years later, we kind of have this answer that actually there's not a great deal of difference on average, in the performance of charter schools versus traditional public schools. There was just this last summer, a research study that came out of Credo, which is associated with Stanford. Mm-hmm. And that group has been studying charter schools basically since the start. And that was the first study from them that really said, okay, charter school students on average have a slight advantage in test scores, but it was incredibly small. I mean, you're talking about maybe the difference between the 50th percentile and like the 50.4. Mm. So just a very, very small difference.
Wisconsin is getting $58 million in federal grants to open or to and expand charter schools in our state. What is the federal government's role in driving change and in driving charter schools at K-12 schools?
Well, it's interesting because up until very recently, there was sort of a bipartisan consensus on charter schools that both Republicans and Democrats really supported charters. You know, and so you had George Bush as a supporter and Bill Clinton as an early supporter and Barack Obama, you know, and those administrations really were in favor of charters and helped, you know, helped sort of popularize the idea, but also provided some money. You know, there's the federal program that provides some money to help charters start. And then also during the Obama years, there was a program where states would apply for money. And part of that had to be, you know, that they were supporting some kind of innovation, and often it was charters.
You know, what would, I'm just wondering the interplay between voucher programs and charter schools. I mean, would charter schools have taken off and been successful in Wisconsin and around the country, you know, as we saw the voucher programs expanding? Like, what's the interplay between those different programs?
This is one of the things that I was really kind of fascinated by in doing the research, was this idea that the charter school, in a way, actually becomes the more successful school choice reform mechanism, if you want to say that. You know, that a lot of Democrats, they essentially needed something to argue back against vouchers. And so charter schools kind of became that answer of, okay, well, we're in favor of choice, but we're in favor of public school choice, and we're in favor of charter schools, you know? And so it's interesting because I think charter schools really took off because it had, the idea had fewer sort of legal questions. You didn't have this church state issue that came up so often with the vouchers. And it seemed a little clearer that a charter school probably was legal, where it wasn't as clear with a voucher. And so that idea really took off. And I think for Republicans, they were like, well, charter schools maybe aren't as great as vouchers, but it's still an idea that we can get behind.
Let's go to Tim now in New Berlin. Tim, hi. What would you like to share?
Yes, you were just saying that there's no significant difference between the voucher school performance and the public school performance. I would say that is not true. The public schools are significantly doing better because the public schools have to take everybody. I know of a classroom myself where there are three students in first grade who are in diapers. That is not because the parents didn't teach them, didn't potty train them. It's because through their own personal disabilities, that is because they have no choice, excuse the pun. What is going on is that for the public schools, considering that they have to take everybody with any mental or physical disability or violent behavior, the voucher schools do not have to do that. It is important to note that if there were a level playing field here, that if the voucher school programs were required to take these students, the public schools would be significantly outperforming the voucher schools.
Tim, thanks for calling in. Kara, can you give us more clarity on that, quote, playing field, if you will?
Yeah, well, I think just to clarify, we were talking about the difference between charter schools and traditional public schools. So if we want to talk about the difference between voucher schools and traditional public schools, there actually the research is worse. There's a number of recent studies of some of the major programs, you know, in Louisiana and in Ohio and in Washington, D.C., that really have shown that students who are using the vouchers actually perform worse on test scores. It can be about the same, and in many cases, it's worse, particularly in regards to math. So just to clarify that on the research front, the research around vouchers is not especially great academically. But on the playing field front, you know, I think that's a very fair comment and criticism, you know, because the public schools do have this obligation to take and serve every child. And so, you know, in some ways, when you're trying to compare these things, that in itself is a major difference. When they're doing the research around these programs, they typically are trying to compare the same types of children, you know, to be able to make those comparisons. And when they do, the vouchers have not shown to be this incredible improving force.
Lori now in Shano. Lori, hi.
Hi. So it seems like religion is getting more and more into just the government. When is the government going to get into these schools and say, okay, you can't teach creationism, you have to teach evolution, you can't teach abstinence only, you got to teach reproductive health? If they're going to ban books, ban the Bible because it's full of violence and cruelty towards animals. I mean, there are schools that have been closed down, and I'm guessing it's because so much money is going towards these schools, these private schools.
Lori, I want Kara to jump in here on what is the role of teaching religion and reproductive health when it comes to voucher programs.
Well, so this is also one of the things that has always been controversial throughout the history, is that once programs started allowing religious schools to participate, it raised all of these questions about, you know, essentially what's being taught in some of those schools and whether or not it's okay to be giving public dollars to a school that maybe is teaching religious beliefs that conflict with scientific fact, for instance. And, you know, the way that the courts have come down on that is that it essentially is okay, you know, because mm-hmm. it's the choice of the parents. And that's something that troubles a lot of people.
Your book ends in 2019 following a visit to Milwaukee by then Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. How much do conversations today about school choice stem from the influence of DeVos during the Trump administration in our last moments together?
Yeah, you know, Betsy DeVos is a longtime school choice supporter, and she was such a polarizing figure as education secretary that I think in some ways it actually harmed the choice movement. You know, you really kind of saw the bipartisanship around charter schools start to evaporate during that time when DeVos held that position. And so her role, you know, as a spokesperson was fairly huge to be in that job. But as in terms of what she actually accomplished, I think the lasting legacy there is really one of divisiveness.
Kara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kara Fitzpatrick is author of The Death of Public School, How Conservatives Won the War Over Education in America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.